Chapter 3, The 10,000 Hours. The 10,000-hour rule has captured the interest of the public, with journalist Daniel Coyle claiming it went mainstream in 2008. By that, he is referring to Malcolm Gladwell's book, Outliers. Much of Gladwell's inspiration seems to come from a paper written in 2002 by Canadian physical educators, Joseph Baker et al. The title of that was Sports Expertise, Factors Influencing the Development of Elite Athletes. A prominent developer of the theory was K. Anders Ericsson in the early 90s, who extolled deliberate practice, which entails, quote-unquote, forms of training that are not intrinsically motivating, require high levels of effort and attention, and do not lead to immediate social or financial rewards. This includes negotiating motivational constraints. Ericsson also notes that, quote-unquote, many characteristics once believed to reflect innate talent are actually the result of intense practice extended for a minimum of 10 years. Earlier foundations by Chase and Simon, who called it the 10-year rule, were worked out in 1973, who, along with Ericsson, found that masters, quote-unquote, develop powerful working memories for the kind of data that shows up in their circumscribed fields. The essence of working memory is the ability to temporarily hold pieces of information in mind bearing on the situation at hand. Baker et al., quote-unquote, in a study of expertise in chess, Chase and Simon indicated that differences between the expert-level players, grandmaster players, and less skilled players, master and novice players, were attributable to the ability to organize information in more meaningful chunks rather than the possession of a superior memory capacity. End quote. One way to express this is the metaphor of the forest and the trees. As the saying goes, these people had a name for every tree, but no name for the forest. But if we spend enough time with individual trees, at some point a forest pops into view. Only one thing to remember, but with lots of pieces in it. Coyle also conveys the disappointment of some prominent voices in sports training on the subject of 10,000 hours. His quote is, "It's absolutely nuts," the head of one nation's soccer federation told me. "Coaches are tracking practice hours and the athletes are clocking in and out with time cards like they're working on an assembly line. There's no ownership, no creativity." So obviously, although learning happens through dumb repetition, just logging the hours won't necessarily cut it. In his fine little book, Mastery, by Esalen co-founder George Leonard, we find four learning curves for those who undertake a discipline, in his case, Aikido. The first, and of course the best, is the master, who gradually develops from plateau to plateau, each one a little higher than the previous. The plateau is where outward progress isn't overtly visible, but where inward things under the surface are developing physically, neurologically, and psychically, and they typically emerge and become evident in surprisingly mature form in a sudden rush. Leonard contends that those who are inclined toward mastery love the plateau. The next three types. The dabbler, who goes from one thing to the next and always quits when he hits a plateau. The obsessive, who goes like crazy and then burns out and burns her bridges. And then the great bummer for our soccer coach above, the hacker. Leonard's quote is, "After sort of getting the hang of the thing, he is willing to stay on the plateau indefinitely. He's a guy who loves hacking around with other hackers." So even if he somehow makes it to 10,000 hours, the hacker is still hacking because he isn't really focusing during his lifetime. Why? Well, one possible reason. Staying with a practice over time will eventually ram us directly into ourselves, including our shadows, the places where the light doesn't easily go. Keep hacking, and these difficult, uncomfortable things can be avoided. If we stay in the moment with focus, which is not hacking, at some point we're going to discover the facts of our limitations, which are surrounded and shrouded by unresolved emotional content. Not everybody is up for that. So, we have to pay attention while we practice if we want to get to a place which could be called mastery. And if we look at this from a yogic perspective, paying attention is the point, and it leads us somewhere, somewhere that likely will become more important than the skills gained in the gross realm by the practice. And if we keep paying attention, we get better at paying attention. I'll get into these last two points in a bit. The literature of 10,000 hours is by and large one of gaining abilities at competitive human endeavors, such as sports, chess, music, law, business. Gladwell's outliers are almost entirely those who have achieved fame and wealth, with a major character in the book, the Montana raised fighter, bouncer, elite genius, writer of A Theory of Everything, Chris Langan, being portrayed as a failure because he didn't make it in academia. As we discovered in the previous chapter, such abilities would by and large be deemed development of vertical lines by the Wilbur Combs lattice. They exist mostly in the gross realm of existence, in a cosmic map that also articulates spiritual levels subtler than the gross. These subtler levels become relevant once we're talking about master and yoga. From the worldview expressed by the WC lattice, gross level mastery, fame, and wealth are all fine, but they're not the whole story, not by a long shot. One way of looking at Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, that quiet, brooding, living text still hiding there behind the profusion of marketplace yogas, is one long celebration of what happens when we focus our attention, allowing it to turn itself inward. The sutras are also a guide to what we'll find if we do. Patapi Joyce used to say, Ashtanga Yoga is Patanjali Yoga, which is to imply 10,000 hours of focused Hatha Yoga practice will do something to us, which will take us somewhere other than just getting better at the asanas. However, we can begin our discussion in the gross realm because physical changes to the body are important in themselves, as well as laying the foundation for the special whole-person transformation that sincere Hatha Yoga can make possible. From a fitness perspective, Hatha Yoga as it is in Ashtanga, which is a root form for most of the Hatha Yoga in the world at this point in time, offers primarily strengthening and stretching in about equal measure, the strength coming from weight-bearing movement and static holds, the stretching sustained in a stable manner between 5 and 8 breaths. To a less but still significant extent, Ashtanga also develops balance and coordination, and it has us turn the body upside down and stay there multiple times per practice. The breath in yoga never gets as deep into aerobic conditioning as the classic aerobic endeavors such as running, but Ashtanga's emphasis on Ujjayi Pranayama develops awareness and intelligence in the lungs and respiration process. These are the basic physical exercise categories in Ashtanga. Like any other kind of physical training, the muscle exercise over time does many amazing things. The following is a list of the main discoveries on the subject from exercise physiology. To begin, the enzyme systems that get nutrients and oxygen into the muscle cells will genetically upgrade, which progressively allows the entire muscle to generate more energy. Mitochondria, the engines in the muscle cells that burn the nutrients, will increase in size and number. This will up the energy consumption of the body, speeding metabolism, which among other benefits burns excess fat. Fit muscles burn fat. New capillaries will grow, surrounding the muscle fibers, allowing greater blood supply. Likewise, the myoglobin content of the cells will increase, which allows faster transfer of oxygen to the mitochondria. The fire which puts energy to use in the mitochondria needs oxygen, just like a flame does. The nerves which control the muscles will steadily improve their synchronization at the level of the motor units. A motor unit is the group of fibers that one nerve controls. Coordination between agonist and antagonist muscles is refined. These last two are known as increased neural drive. The muscles will grow both the size of their existing fibers as well as the number of fibers, i.e., the muscles will get bigger. The filaments that force movement between the fibers within the muscle, the basis for muscle contraction, will increase in number. The muscles will increase their storage of exercise-ready fat and glycogen, as well as the speed that they can restock these stores after exertion, especially in endurance-trained people. So to sum all that up, the muscles have multiple responses to regular exertion. They're just waiting for it to present itself. These gains are temporary. Muscles worked on Monday will typically peak in their growth response by Wednesday, or later than that if soreness takes more time to clear, and will begin to degrade thereafter. So if one practices on Monday and then goes on bed rest, Much of her progress will be lost somewhere around Saturday for endurance-type gains, with strength-type gains degrading slower than that. Which is to say, to keep the muscle on an upgrade curve, they need to be worked at least twice a week, and with progressively greater loads. If one works up to a certain level of asana intensity and keeps it there, the muscles will improve up to that level and eventually go no further. If the yogi quits asana and just lives a daily life without specific exercise, the muscles will downgrade to the level that is required of them. Lots of chores, couch potato, whatever. Ligaments, the collagen bands that connect bone to bone, and tendons, the collagen bands that connect muscle to bone, will also upgrade. The repeated strains on these bands will stimulate an increase in collagen production. The fibers within the bands will organize with maximum alignment advantage towards strength in the direction of the forces being asked of them. If exercise stops, the advantageous fiber alignment gradually loses its organization and the bandwidth decreases. The same goes for bones. Exercise makes them stronger, more durable, less brittle. In particular, bones need at minimum the weight-bearing loads of the Earth's gravitational force to be healthy. There's a unique page in Wikipedia called Spaceflight Osteopenia, which is the unforeseen calamity of gradual bone deterioration that astronauts suffer from the mere fact of no gravity out there for the bones to work against. Fittingly, the best bone workouts are load-bearing, which yoga covers quite nicely for upper and lower body bones. If you're hiking, it is the downhill part that really convinces them to upgrade. The cells that make up bones are called osteoblasts, and they need movement and stress to even function. Bones will be most dense in exactly the areas where the most stress is received. And similar to muscles, when the exertion routine is stopped over time, the bones, as well as tendons and ligaments, will get closer to the strength of what is asked of them, and they will also become more brittle. Surprisingly, most of the fitness gains that happen to athletes are covered above. Stuff I just said. Believe it or not, this is even the case for distance runners with whom many of us would associate strong hearts and lungs. The heart as a muscle does upgrade like other muscles, but apparently not as much. A very fit individual will have larger stroke volume than he did before he began exercising, which is the amount of blood his heart can pump per beat. But this has been described as a drop in the bucket compared to what happens to the muscles that are primarily used in the exercise, i.e. for runners, legs and hips. As for the lungs, they barely change at all, with endurance athletes primarily gaining greater neurological skill at using the lungs. We know that this also happens to yogis who regularly engage pranayamas. The lungs get smarter, but as per the literature, they don't really change much. What does change is blood volume in the entire body, which goes up with exercise, as well as the chemistry that delivers the oxygen to the cells, as I already mentioned. All these strength gains happen equally across gender. Of course, mature women have a special hormonal situation with their bones, but if a woman is dealing with bone loss, the more exercise she can get, the better, as long as nothing gets too rough. Interestingly enough, as far as muscle strength, women's muscles are exactly the same strength as men's on a fiber-to-fiber basis. The difference is that women have more adipose tissue, fat, mixed into a muscle with the same area as that of a man. Women's muscles are usually smaller than men's also. Otherwise, the training curve and ultimate limit per fiber are exactly the same. So that's all strength conditioning stuff. Yoga also obviously has the stretching part. Intelligent stretching will lengthen the fibers of muscles, tendons, and ligaments, as well as creating a little more space between fibers. Modulus is a mathematical term used in exercise science to express the elasticity of tissues. Increasing the modulus of muscles, tendons, and ligaments will allow them to receive a blow by warping but not snapping. Stretching will increase the modulus of these parts. Modulus will be increased in bones as well, but primarily through the strengthening work. A primary indicator of stretching's benefits is that of increased joint mobility. Such gains allow freedom of movement and far greater options for movement, which in addition to the obvious physical advantage, has big psychological benefits in terms of felt interior spaciousness. This last benefit is a major aspect of Hatha Yoga's larger purpose of reformatting the body and opening it up, allowing the soul to reside deeply within it, which provides a foundation for an approach to the timeless pursuit of the spiritual life. More on these last few points in a bit. Range of motion gains by stretching seem to go on the rule that 6 weeks of practice will be lost after 4 weeks off. The published physiological studies primarily reflect stretching effects on dabblers, or maybe even hackers. In one of the most cited studies, they only stretch for 6 weeks. I found that those of us who do this over years eventually gain a very durable flexibility once we're warmed up. But it is true that if you stop stretching, the body will become less flexible. All of these are essentially the body's incredibly evolved need to not just receive the shock and awe of life on Earth, but actually dial up its abilities in the face of such challenges. After an exhausting workout, the body doesn't merely recover, but also upgrades its abilities. All of it happens completely unconsciously, higher mind and deeper awareness not needed. Millennia of nasty brutishness for cavemen and women bequeathed us moderns a set of genes prepared for messages of stress and strain, genes that respond by sending out developmental materials that won't be forthcoming otherwise. Couch potato cavemen got assimilated in the bellies of saber-toothed cats and did not pass on their genes. The statistics on total bed rest are astonishing. Studies on coma patients, where the body doesn't move at all, show that just getting up to putz around to the bathroom for a few minutes before getting back in bed does a lot. 12 weeks in bed and the bones will be half their beginning density and strength. Tendons and ligaments will be 60%. All three will greatly lose their elasticity. Muscles will atrophy at 12% a week. After 12 weeks, that's not much left. Nerves will die back and lose their capacity to organize motor function. All told, not a pretty picture. So, keeping all this science in mind, I'd like to move on to a deeper dimension of exercise, that which physiology terms the training effect. It is one step up on the consciousness evolutionary ladder, although it too shows up on its own as a response to experience. It's just that it can also be subjected to helpful degrees of conscious awareness. That is to say, it will happen unconsciously if need be, but awareness can make it happen more and better. Physiologically, it is primarily neurological and is likely a function of receptor processes in other types of cells as well. It can be exemplified by the phenomenon of learning to ride a bicycle. We can see two parts of bicycle training, one obviously being the fact of learning how to ride the bike itself, the other being the building up of strength and stamina through training. The latter comes and goes as per the conditioning factors already mentioned. The former is rarely ever lost once gained. I've noticed that women who logged long hours in dance studios as girls have better balance than most everybody else, even though few of them are still practicing dance. And in my own experience, once I've discovered a solution to an Ashtanga challenge, I don't lose it. On inwardly hazy days, I may lose sight of it, but once clarity returns, it's still there. This is a problem for the aging ex-basketball player. His nerves still remember how to slam dunk, but after doing so, his body says to him, "What the hell did you just do?" In developmental psychology, once a cognitive level has been attained by a child, it is not lost except under situations of regression or dementia. Once the stressor that caused the regression is resolved, the highest attained level is typically regained. That level then becomes the foundation upon which development eventually proceeds to the next one. So the general conclusion here, muscles, tendons, ligaments, and bones come and go. Barring illness, nerves are relatively permanent. Once laid down, a nerve circuit will lose a nerve or two, or a million, will lose details and refinement with non-use, will be subject to potentially constant modification according to experience, but the basic foundations of the overall circuit will remain in place, even if rarely used. Sequential cognitive levels of development, as mentioned above, can be likened to computer operating systems. Our current cognitive level becomes the software running the background engine which powers the entire show moment to moment. As we go through life, particularly in the earlier years, just by gathering experiences and data, doesn't really matter what kind of experiences, the body-mind will eventually gather enough information and stimulus to get the wherewithal to self-update its own operating system in a relatively sudden process into something more adequate to the life complexity encountered. For adults who choose the road less traveled, this can continue throughout life. Recent lab findings have also added a new dimension to the neurological picture, that of exercise's incredibly positive effect on the brain. The brain is like the muscles in that its training and use will positively condition it. There are those who see a hill to walk up, and they do not want to do it, and they don't. Likewise, there are those who sense intellectual and developmental challenges, and they don't want to accept them, and they don't. Body and mind not used up to their capacity. Fortunately, The more common problem for your typical person is on the other side of that equation. She is too stressed out and feels daunted by life's difficulties. Her mind and emotional chemistry are overtaxed. Such a situation releases crisis chemicals into the body and brain, such as cortisol. Put a neuron in cortisol and it tends to shrink back its dendrites, which are the branches that connect it to the rest of the brain. The unhappy conclusion: too much stress causes brain damage. So, inconveniently, the mental exercise which helps the mind develop now crosses over into too much, which becomes stress, which starts to break the brain down, whereby one needs to find a way to rest the brain so that it can be ready to receive such strong inputs and translate them towards mental fitness. The stress muscle, when rested and fed, will become stronger. The same with the brain. And hard work followed by rest is different than constant rest without the hard work part. In yoga terminology, the latter here, lots of rest without hard work, leads to tapas, thick, dark sluggishness. The former, if done in balance, leads to sattva, lucid, illuminated, energetic peace. The only problem is that resting the overworked, stressed brain isn't always easy to do. Enter yoga. Cortisol is not the whole story. There's another chemical called bone-derived neurotrophic factor, or BDNF. Put a neuron in it, and it grows dendrites. One of the best ways to release BDNF is exercise. A way to release more BDNF: stronger exercise. And BDNF has cousin chemicals also released by physical exertion and with similar effects. There's lots of research on this, and a good starting point for it is John Ratey's book Spark, where he outlines the ways in which nature has set us up so that exercise allows incredible optimum chemistry for both brain health and mood. Up to a point, the stronger the exercise, the better in this regard. Most of the research is based on aerobic studies. My personal experience was that as a competitive runner, I knew the joys of relaxing after the workout, the runner's high. I also discovered the different kinds of exercise had different kinds of cocktails, all of them pretty good once enough rest happened. When I got to strong hatha yoga, I couldn't believe it. It was by far the best. Studies still need to be done to get into what the yoga high's exact chemistry is, but the consensus is clear. Yoga helps you feel really good, and you even begin to take such a state for granted. Any discipline taken up with focus, Ashtanga, ballet, piano, chess, will emphasize exercise in a specific set of bodily regions and nerve circuits. Put in the 10,000 and those circuits will be utterly robust, bushy, fleshed out, ramified, with huge numbers of connections within the circuit, as well as to the rest of the brain and nervous system. Play chess with a 10,000-hour guy and you will not be seeing the same board as he sees. Not only does each piece pattern fire off actual experientially learned circuits for him, not speculation but actual hard knocks, been there, seen that memory, but also, as per the literature, he has an ability to hold more chess patterns in his working memory than you do in yours, even if you have a better than average working memory. In piano playing, he will not have that memory advantage. In chess, he does. How does this operate in yoga? Well, for one thing, by the time one has done 10,000 hours of focused hatha yoga, she will no longer view the practice simply as physical fitness, unless she's a truly committed hacker. Depending on her inclination, she will have varying degrees of achievement in the subtle spheres of existence by then. If one does Ashtanga and settles year after year into pose after pose, staying in each one of them at least 5 breaths, focusing, noticing, there'll be some results from the universal human need to remain on our evolutionary edge, our creative edge, our interested, curious, alive edge. One would have to actively fight to stay down to avoid this. As a cave woman, it was essential to her survival. In our cultured age, we can now take the same urge and apply it towards self-realization. And 10,000 hours is way too long for people who don't want to go in this direction. They'd already be on the video games, yoga mat forgotten in the corner. This human trait will take us on a particular path in hatha yoga. Specifically, all that time in feeling and breathing and generating a somatic representation while attempting to quiet the surface mind to get at the authentic felt process in the now will take us from grosser to subtler experiences. Following bodily felt sensation, Vedana, which presents itself prominently in Hatha Yoga, the gross sensation, that hamstring stretch, will give rise to subtler energetic currents that flow throughout the body, with stronger concentrations in the areas recognized by subtle tantric physiology as the chakras, the most obvious emphasis winding up in the heart and the brain, and eventually flowing out beyond the physical body into the transpersonal subtle realms, outside of the body but still clearly and obviously felt, in a progression that gets ever subtler without end as to how subtle it can get. So that previous paragraph sequence went from gross to subtle in a straight journey. Such a description is an ideal and illustrative model, basically accurate. But most people come to yoga as full-fledged adults, having already passed through the gross younger realms by whatever walks life has taken them, many of them already with some spiritual experience, basically all of them intellectually developed to lesser or greater degrees. Anybody with a reasonably developed intellect is already flirting around with at least the denser regions of the subtle realm. So the normal yoga situation becomes one of culturing an already developed mind, one that may be quite competent in its regular spheres of activity. It frequently becomes one of taming that mind, teasing apart discursive mind from yoga mind, and training it to develop from mind to body mind, transforming stress into body mind exercise. I came myself to Hatha Yoga as a Dionysian Buddhist meditator seeking somatic grounding, which is to say that I was already out there and wanted to turn my body into a vessel which would help me realize the gifts, abilities, and profundities of the subtle spheres in a manageable way. Like most everyone, I had already gone from gross to subtle in kind of a zigzag fashion. I had thorny issues at all levels of that spectrum, and I was hoping to shore up gaps that manifested as unsuccessful, less than happy experiences. I was also drawn by the possibility of consistent bliss. So, I would put the Hatha Yoga master, different than the chess master, in this category. Someone who can navigate the subtler spheres of existence while firmly and powerfully grounded in the gross realm. Whereas the chess master has been gaining a primarily intellectual ability to interpret chessboard configurations into predictions and actions, the yogi has been attempting to bring the body with her as she ascends the gradations of spiritual states and has done this not by detaching from the body, but by mastering it from within. Before I sketch out features of this process, I want to mention here that one of the common themes of sages and yogis through the ages is that the individual's path along the great chain of being, and specifically through the higher states of spiritual life, through the subtle realms, is one of movement towards something less illusory and more real from an individual experiential perspective. Note right away that this puts the scientific materialist realm exactly on its head, with science only accepting gross realm phenomena that can get through their labs as real. Physics is getting pretty small with bosons and gluons, but even these become knowledge as a result of outward IT investigations, gigantic, incredibly expensive machines devoted to getting a material measurement, which are essentially tiny little bits of the gross surface realm. And also note, creating the machines that get these exceptionally particular outward measurements and interpreting the results requires immense internal intellectual work, work that can actually have great leverage in transforming internal consciousness states if valued and applied in that direction. A powerful intellect can become a strong engine for psychosomatic evolution. Scientists can potentially become great yogis. Now, concerning the highest states of consciousness, the causal realm, which is quote-unquote beyond the subtle realm, Sri Aurobindo says, "The mind, when it passes those gates suddenly, receives a sense of the unreality of the world and the sole reality of the silence, which is one of the most powerful and convincing experiences of which the human mind is capable." From the yogic perspective, the subtle realms begin to carry more weight and become more interesting than gross-level experiences. If our yogi from above stays on her mat for 10,000 hours, she hopefully will not devalue the hamstring stretch, although that tack has been taken heavily in the history of the world's spiritual life, as we've seen, but it is quite likely that she will eventually become unable to ignore how alluring the subtle currents themselves are, especially when the more she does it, the more they become very, very real. And as discussed in the previous chapter, one of the reasons the higher realms are so compelling is the organizational possibilities and organizational pressure they offer upon the more normal spheres of life. The fact that a larger sense of identity can greatly help one's work in smaller realms. So we have two directions. Spiritual life can help outward abilities, such as scientific intellect, and well-developed outward abilities can contribute to spiritual attainment. I go into this quite a bit more in the Yoga Mind chapter. Alas, for most of us coming to Hatha Yoga, staying with a hamstring actually won't be an easy thing to do. A lot of work will be needed simply to get that in place. In fact, willingness to undertake the effort to keep attention on the gross somatic field presented by the asana will be the first great value of the spiritual aspect of yoga, because it will be a focusing point, an altar, if you will, for the mental process she had when she walked in. That mental process will want to simply carry on with business as usual, and it takes some determination at first, and regularly thereafter, to drag the consciousness in the yoga practice direction. If instructed or instinctively inclined to put the focus on the sensations in her body during practice, working with the focus point, she will feel the effects of and eventually notice a force that not only organizes the mind, but also matures the emotions. So that after practice, that mind stream she walked in with will be clearer, its themes a little further along, less wacky, less tortured. If she goes through an hour and a half yoga class where she struggles and at times succeeds in focusing on her body and surrendering to her breath, this will be the beneficial cumulative effect to greater or lesser degrees pretty much guaranteed. Using bodily sensation as the object of concentration allows a unique degree of mind-body integration, and the process of leaning into this object on a regular basis is the beginning of what happens to us if we keep doing this. As per the training effect previously mentioned, if Hatha Yoga practice is done over time, its subtle moves will gradually become stably established and habitual, and fluency will be gained using the experienced in the moment body to benefit the life of the mind. The physiologic benefits discussed previously, strengthening and stretching from muscles to tendons to ligaments to bones, can become the body's way of reformatting itself towards greater capacity to embrace and contain the stream of the mind. As we all know, that mind stream is periods in time where all is well and easy. Other times are not easy. Stretches of fear, despair, hurt, anxiety, misery, the various and sundry things that have always bugged us and still bug us. The dark side of the fact that our thoughts are accompanied by feelings. Difficult feelings have a depth to them that can seem insurmountable. They reach so far down and come in so strong. The ever more fit, regularly practiced Hatha Yoga body begins to become a resonation chamber big and robust enough to handle the intensity of these feelings. When things get hard or confusing or awful for the mind, it has a resource in place to draw upon. The body. And like muscles, practicing that very resource will make it into an even stronger resource. If we stay with yoga, moving towards mastery, there is the possibility to eventually rise through all levels from gross to incredibly subtle, allowing landscapes to form within ourselves which can potentially contain any and all existential dilemmas. Except for the final big one, more on that in a moment. Trying to keep the mind quiet while we practice, continually returning our attention to the work of the asana, and noticing how eventually the mind floats away, bringing it back. Noticing that it is not always thoughts that pull us away from our gross level focus region, but sometimes it is the unspoken, authentic, subtle environment behind the thoughts once the discursive part has been quieted. When we explore this region, we begin to register phenomena that we didn't notice before because they were hidden beneath discursive mind. Very interesting phenomena. These are the subtle currents, nakedly sensed, and they will begin to beckon. And when we are ready, we will willingly go. There is something inherently attractive about them. And as presented in the previous chapter, if we are properly positioned, there is also the chance that they will simply take us. They are the stairway to heaven. Navigating these new realms needs learning time, The body-mind needs time to lay down the subtle structure just like grosser-level skills. We won't lose what we had, but we'll be integrating something more. My experience with the subtle realm has 10,000 hours is just the beginning. The gross realm is what our senses see, hear, smell, taste, touch in the concrete outside world. Not an illusion, very real, right there. In turn, a spectrum expressing the realm of finer stuff than the gross is sometimes labeled psychic on one end of the spectrum and subtle on the other, with subtle disappearing into the ether in its endlessly increasing subtleness. I've been calling this entire area subtle, that which isn't registered by our gross outward five senses. Again, common spiritual wisdom points to this realm as the same place we go when we dream at night. Like dreams, it can be quite vivid, unbelievably beautiful, more so than the gross realm, deliciously exciting, terrifying like a nightmare, full of resonant meaning, totally absorbing, weird. It can feel awful, but it often feels really, really good, as if things are falling into place and healing, which I contend they are. Occasional peak experiences of the subtle are one thing, but to live from there, one needs a very strong yoga body, which I would call a body that has capacities from the gross to the subtle. The subtle end of this yoga body is like a retractable antenna. It is not easy to keep our consciousness up there. Initial glimpses giving rise to a steady practice which is open to the subtle will lay down yoga structure over time. A strong teacher and community of fellow practitioners helps immensely. Nevertheless, as we get stronger and manage to sustain the subtle life for a while, we will unavoidably, even regularly, run into situations over our heads, either as a result of what is happening in our lives or due to the potency of what is coming in, even if we've done the 10,000. At which point, the antenna will retract and we will keep our awareness closer to the gross body. But as yoga practice continues, we will be able to stay out in the subtle regions longer, eventually centering our gravity at a higher state, ready to get curious about the country beyond it. The subtle life brings with it tensions that are different than the tensions of gross level world's exposure, and my belief is that Hatha Yoga historically arose from the basis of meditation-only Raja Yoga, bringing in physical exercise and exquisite concern for bodily regions, the spine in particular, as a way of building a strength that allows these subtle tensions to relax. The weaker yoga body is tense, the stronger one relaxed. Movement along this path is not a newfound discovery. The sages have been clearly or mysteriously talking about it for millennia. Some have been yelling about it. And it has been universally described as not just a path of increasing scope, but also of increasing bliss. Just in case you as listener had any questions as to why one would want to go there. It arises inevitably and authentically and irresistibly from the matrix of our regular practice, which had already brought good things in the way of physical fitness and mind-body integration. Proliferate awareness of the subtle currents and subtle territory is only more good things. Taking this path will put many of our previous dreadful crises into perspective. They will lose their awful bite. Delights will be felt more delightfully, meaning will resonate more powerfully, humor begins to lurk around every corner, the grim drama turns to heartfelt sorrow expressed by healing tears. I mentioned previously the one final big one, and it is this. The great sages in history have merged their identity with what Patanjali calls the drashtu, the seer. Like it or not, he is already onto this 11 words into his sutras. One need not get all the way through the subtle realms to reach this state. Several traditions bypass a percentage of quote-unquote all this yogi stuff, and through variations on inquiry and perspective-altering techniques, get the practitioners to realize that the awareness behind the ears by which you hear these words right now is that very drashtu. You are already there as we speak. It can't be attained because it's already in place, always was. Yes, the language of the ultimate perspective sounds like that. Anything less than that solution brings about issues of division. If you can survive the first 200 pages of Aurobindo's Life Divine, you'll understand something of division. It will be pounded into your head, really. And I won't belabor it here so much as to say that the entire gross realm into the subtle realm, which is the subject of this entire chapter until now, all of it is initially experienced in a divided manner. Doesn't matter how subtle it is, it's still divided. This brings a paradox that the deepest sages have felt a need to resolve. For these saints and Zen masters and yogis, this incompleteness was unbearable, and it spurred them on to the non-dual, which is another story, and not one which I will go into much further in this book beyond the previous chapter and the following issue. Hatha yoga is a gradualist practice, which can be contrasted with what we can call an inquiry or go straight to non-dual, do not pass go practice, very briefly touched in the previous discussion. Hatha yoga is actually even more gradual than many gradualist meditation approaches because it brings the whole body with us, and it clears psychic stuff out as its method, clearing the internal field in a way that can be likened to a light bulb covered in mud. The mud is our karma, our mind stuff, our attachment to dense egoic ways of seeing and acting. The light bulb is the pure seer, the jivatman, the witness. And as the karmic mud covering it is gradually removed, its light begins to shine forth. Through practice, as old drives toward thought and action are transcended and replaced by subtler and more sophisticated forms of themselves, the worldly issues and nags that once tormented us begin to lose their bite. This work will require an evolution of our personhood, which will include variations on the following: working beyond old emotional patterns, integrating incongruous aspects of ourselves, telling the truth to ourselves, laying down deeper emotional resources that can handle the diminishment of ego, acting in the world with greater consciousness, gaining access to and control over depths of the body-mind which were previously unconscious. Ken Wilber speaks in a hapless tone of non-dual schmucks, characters who, through one of the straight-to-non-dual practices, has realized an identity with a witness without having gone through much of the trial of internal transformation mentioned above. They didn't clear everything out to gain the light from the light bulb. They simply skipped right to the light, leaving the bulb covered with varying degrees of mud. All gradualists have mud still, but the gradualist process intentionally removes it to reveal the light. Non-dualists often stress that not very much of this is needed. This may be accompanied by a strong urge to evolve the whole person, but it also may not. For example, let's say that I, Steve, have attained a stable identification with awareness itself, and that I have no identification with the Steve guy who walks around and does Steve stuff. He's there doing what he does, acting out his internal drives, and I can observe this process with very little sense that he is who I am. From this perspective, I may choose to go through the evolutionary trials belabored in this and the previous chapter, or I may not. Such trials and efforts lead to vertical development, and from a non-identified yogic perspective can be pursued with an intensity that is likely impossible from closer to ego identification perspectives. But if I'm a non-dual schmuck, I may watch Steve not go through these internal trials required to reformat the way he acts, and merely observe him as he gets drunk, hits his wife, and has sex with porn stars. See Adi Da for an example of a guru who, by all accounts, had achieved great degrees of yogic freedom, and yet indulged a lifestyle not far from, and in some ways worse than, the failings I just described. As Wilber has belabored in his book Integral Spirituality, non-identification yoga practices do not necessarily lead to a full maturity of the person by themselves. Specifically, non-dual practices may not have sufficient transformative traction on psychosomatic material to affect the kind of change that psychotherapy can have or a well-intentioned householder life requires. On the other hand, gradualist practice requires essential development of the person as the way to get to the light. I want to affirm a yoga which does not in any way negate the subtle currents, or even the gross currents. The gross mind opening to the subtle mind is a way of following the path from waking to dreaming while still awake. The dream realm is the way the sleeping mind prepares itself to go into deep sleep. A tiny percentage of those who center themselves at the subtle level will want to press on, and will succeed at it largely through an act of grace. Others, having centered at the nidra state, deep sleep while still awake, will then move into sahaja, the no-taste, where all states are integrated, without needing to get the subtle realm worked out too much. My proposition is that a stably grounded residence in the subtle realm is a good idea in and of itself, as well as for those who have the guts to go onward, partly because, I contend, to remain there on a consistent basis, one has to clean oneself out and get through one's stuff, shadows and all. Also, it is the most likely place from which to realize non-dual reality. And also, because it is such a wonderful place, the muse lives there, the gods and goddesses. They periodically peek through in bliss hints, which have stirred sensitive artists throughout history. The perennial poet's longing instincts through the ages haven't been wrong. It is a place of haunting beauty and awesome aliveness. On the incredible journey of Hatha Yoga, 10,000 hours is just the beginning, and the adventure into bliss that awaits is very real. If I were your teacher, I would try to help you get out there stably first with strength. From there, the divine may claim you, at which point we will become one, you and I.